it's my pleasure to introduce Sue Prideaux, an acclaimed art historian, biographer, and author. She was educated in Florence, in Paris, and in London, and she's written award-winning biographies. And her latest one, as I say, is on Paul Gauguin. It's the first full Gauguin biography in 30 years. It offers a very bold, revisionist portrait of this artist and the man behind the myth. We're absolutely delighted. So were Duff Cooper, who awarded her a prize for this book. Everybody, put your hands together for Sue Prideaux.
Thank you, Sian, and thank you. You're applauding me before I've even opened my mouth, which is a little risky. And I know I have to compete with gunfire and the sound of heads falling into the basket beneath the guillotine. So I'm going to do my best, and thanks a lot for coming. I'm going to start by telling you why I wrote the book, which is that in 2019, there was an exhibition of... You can hear me, can't you? Yeah? Good. Cool. Okay. 2019, an exhibition of Gauguin's portraits at the National Portrait Gallery. All hell broke loose. Gauguin was a colonialist who spread syphilis to underage girls throughout the South Seas, and there were calls for him to be cancelled and his paintings to be burnt. For me, this was a dilemma. I'd always loved Gauguin's pictures, but I'd just come out of 4 years writing my biography of the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. So morals and ethics were very much on my mind. Could I really get away with the dodgy old excuse of loving the art and hating the man? Not without being a major hypocrite, obviously. My job as a biographer is to discover the truth as best I can. So I set to. Was Gauguin a paedophile? The age of consent in France and the colonies at the time was 13, pretty typical of the world in the 1880s. The American states, for instance, varied between 10 and 12, except the state of Delaware, where it was 7. As I was coming to the end of writing my book, the June before last, Japan raised the age from 13. It's horrifying and disgusting, but Gauguin was doing nothing illegal or, I'm afraid, at all unusual for the context of the time. Did he have syphilis? 4 of his teeth were discovered, examined by the Human Genome Project in Cambridge and other labs around the world. In 2018, their findings were written up in a scientific journal, and no evidence of syphilis was found. A couple of new literary sources drove the book. In 2020, Gauguin's most important written manuscript resurfaced. Avant et après, he called it. 200 handwritten pages covering his thoughts on God, life, art, everything. The manuscript had been known about, but lost for a century following his death, and suddenly it reappeared, offered to the British government in lieu of death duties. It's now in the courtyard, and they were incredibly generous, allowing me to use it however I wanted. Then, in 2021, the catalogue raisonné was completed. This is like the official Bible of an artist, gives you all the information on all the known works. And as if all that wasn't enough, I discovered a great-granddaughter living in England, outside Oxford, with a marvelous treasure trove of family papers, many in Danish and Norwegian. Gauguin had a Danish wife and a son who lived in Norway. Norwegian is my mother tongue, so I can read both languages. There hadn't been a biography of Gauguin for 30 years, and with so much material, really, how could I not do it? So, Paul Gauguin, born in Paris in 1848, that great year of revolutions. Charles-Louis Napoleon was preparing to seize the throne of France and rule as Emperor Napoleon III. Gauguin's father was a staunch Republican, a political journalist on the list of the secret police. If Napoleon grabbed the throne, he'd be shut up in the Bastille. So he fled to Peru, taking his wife, Eileen. Ooh, come on. Where are you, Eileen? Ha ha, there she is. Okay. And Gauguin, who was then 18 months old. And this is Eileen painted by Gauguin. During the voyage to Peru, Gauguin's father had a heart attack and died. He was only 35. But Eileen was feisty and she made her way to the enormous fortress-like palace where her great uncle, who had been governor of Peru, now ruled over a large extended family. Gauguin adored it. Vast, mysterious interiors like a Caravaggio painting, cavernous gloom lit by silver candlesticks as high and as heavy as a man. Outdoors, running wild through jungle, vultures, jaguars, snakes, snow-capped volcanoes belching fire. And he writes about it like a magical realist Eden. All his life, all his art harks back to that place. But when he was 7, his mother thought it time for him to learn to read and write. Boarding school in France. He hated it. It rained all the time. The sky was grey. School uniform. He couldn't speak French. He was teased and bullied. And he hurled himself into fights, yelling, "I'm a wild thing from Peru." Gauguin, the rebel, was born. His despairing mother, enrolled the rebellious teenager in the merchant navy. He knocked around the world, lost his virginity to an opera singer in Brazil, and in 1870, the Franco-Prussian War broke out, and Gauguin's ship, which we see here, the very, very ship, was used to transport prisoners of war. A wild thing himself, Gauguin hated the spectacle of human imprisonment, so he jumped ship in Toulon and made his way up war-torn France to Paris. His mother was dead. Her house was destroyed. But her lover, very decently, fixed Gauguin up with a job in the Paris Stock Exchange, where he was a most unlikely success. He made pots of money. What did he do with it? Well, he was famous for owning 14 pairs of trousers. But apart from that, he bought Impressionist pictures. This is 1874, the first Impressionist exhibition, and Gauguin bought Degas, Manet, and Cézanne. And you've been waiting for me to talk about Gauguin's art, but it's only now, when he's aged 25, that he starts to paint, teaching himself by copying the Impressionist pictures he bought. This is one of his early pictures, and I can't think of many other artists who didn't touch a brush before they were 25. 5 years later, by the fourth Impressionist exhibition in 1879, he was exhibiting alongside his heroes. The unstoppable impulse to make art coincided with meeting the love of his life, a feisty, independent Danish woman called Mette Gard, and it was love at first sight. And here she is. And this, believe it or not, is Gauguin's first effort at sculpture. Their early marriage was a blast. They were hippie and wild and carelessly rich and living in the artist quarter, where Bartholdi's Statue of Liberty was rising above the rooftops of Paris and Rodin was hammering away at his gates of hell. Here is Gauguin's breakthrough picture. Woman Sewing, 1880. Impressionist in style, if you look at the brush strokes, but not in content. She's a world away from typical Impressionist idealization of feminine beauty. Her slumped figure and pot belly drew a lot of criticism. But the important critic, Huysmans, understood that Gauguin was seeing beauty in reality. He wrote that not since Rembrandt had there been such a truthful realization of the female body. In 1882, the Paris stock market crashed. Gauguin lost everything. House, job, money, wife. Mette left him to move back to her family in Denmark, taking their 5 children. And here she is, just before she left, a furious wife turning away from her husband. Skint and alone, Gauguin took a train to the cheapest and wildest place he could afford. Brittany, where they still wore medieval dress and didn't even speak French. Two paintings, Breton Girls Dancing, 1888, show how turning his back on the Paris art scene moved his painting from Impressionism to his own voice. This one still shows strong Impressionist technique in the broken brush strokes, realistic colour, and gentle subject matter, all set in a conventional perspective picture box. But here, The Vision of the Sermon, painted in the same year, shazam, you're straight into post-impressionism. Out of the window goes realism. The figures exist against a flat red colour field. Conventional perspective is disregarded, as is careful 3D shadowed moulding of objects. Scale is wonky. A twisted tree is slashed across the space, bisecting it diagonally. Post-impressionism was born in this painting. And as The Vision has attained the status of fridge magnet, I'll spend a bit of time on it. It's a real event witnessed by Gauguin. Once a year in every Brittany village, they held a wrestling contest. The tradition came down from pagan times, when it ended in the loser having his throat cut by a druid priest. But when Christianity came to Brittany, about 1460, the wrestling match continued, but there was no more human sacrifice. Instead, the winner was awarded a cow, and the whole village had its sins pardoned. Here, the Breton women have just listened to a sermon given by the tonsured priest on the right on Jacob wrestling with the angel. Gauguin explains in a letter to Vincent van Gogh that beneath the tree's real space, what he actually saw, the Breton women, the priest, the prize cow tied to a tree, above the tree is imagined space. The wrestling boys are transformed into the subject of the sermon, Jacob wrestling with the angel. And Gauguin says the figures also symbolize himself wrestling with the tough process of creating art. Gauguin's letter includes a sketch of the picture, and a few weeks later, Van Gogh took the device of the tree trunk bisecting the space in his iconic picture, The Sower, another allegorical masterpiece. In 1888, Van Gogh had become obsessed with the idea of painting with Gauguin. He sent Gauguin this self-portrait with an invitation to come and live with him. Gauguin accepted with this self-portrait. I'd like to read you about their time together from my book. And this passage is based on Gauguin's account. Arriving at the Yellow House, the street door led straight into Van Gogh's studio. Gauguin thought it looked as if a volcano had erupted. It shocked me. His colour box could hardly contain all those tubes, crowded together, their tops never screwed on. Paints were expensive. To see them drying in the uncapped tube was agonising. There were canvases everywhere, stacked, rolled, pinned, higgledy-piggledy, walls smudged with colour from careless contact with undried pictures. Preparing for Gauguin's arrival, Van Gogh had painted the famous sunflowers. 6 sunflowers, 14 sunflowers, 15 sunflowers, all to hang in Gauguin's bedroom like a huge welcoming bouquet for his guest, wrote Van Gogh. The two of them painted together for a couple of months. Gauguin takes up the narrative. In the latter part of my stay, Van Gogh became excessively hasty and noisy, and then silent. Some nights I caught him standing up and coming over to my bed. One evening we went to the cafe. He took a light absinthe. Suddenly he threw the glass and its contents in my face. I avoided the blow, taking him determinedly in my arms, went out of the cafe, across the Place Victor Hugo. Not long afterwards, Van Gogh was in his bed. In a few seconds, he was asleep. When he awoke in the morning, he said to me very calmly, "My dear Gauguin, I have a vague memory that I offended you last night. I forgive you gladly and with all my heart, but yesterday's scene might occur again, and I might lose control of myself. So allow me to write your brother and tell him that I'm going back to Paris." December the 23rd, my God, what a day! When evening came, I felt the need to go out alone and get some fresh air. I had almost crossed through the Place Victor Hugo when I heard behind me short, quick, irregular steps. I turned around. Van Gogh was rushing towards me, an open razor in his hand. My gaze at that moment must have been quite powerful, for he stopped and, lowering his head, set off running towards home. Was I over-lenient on this occasion? Should I have disarmed him and tried to calm him down? I have often questioned my conscience about this, but I have never found anything to reproach myself with. Let him throw a stone at me who wishes. I dared not go home. I booked myself into a hotel, where I was so agitated I could not get to sleep until 3 a.m, and I woke rather late, about 7:30. Getting to the square, I saw a great crowd gathered. Near our house were some police officers and a small gentleman in a bowler hat, the chief of police. This is what had happened. Van Gogh had gone back to the house and had immediately cut off his ear close to the head. It must have taken him some time to stop the flow of blood, for the day after there were a lot of wet towels lying about on the tiles in the 2 ground floor rooms. The blood had stained the 2 rooms red and the little stairway that led up to our bedrooms. When he was in a condition to go out, he had pulled a Basque beret low down over his ear and went straight to a house where in every country one can find an acquaintance. Gauguin means a brothel. He gave the person on duty his ear, carefully cleaned and placed in an envelope. "Here is a souvenir of me," he said. And then he ran home, where he went to bed and fell asleep. I had not the faintest idea about all this when I presented myself at the doorstep of our house in the morning, and the gentleman in the bowler hat accused me point blank of murder. "What have you done, sir, to your friend?" "I don't know." "Oh, yes, you know very well. He is dead." I could never wish anyone such a moment. It took me a few minutes to get my wits together and control the beating of my heart. "All right, sir, let's go upstairs where we can discuss." In the bed lay Van Gogh, humped up like a gun dog. He seemed lifeless. Gently, very gently, I touched the body, whose heat announced he was definitely alive. It was for me the recovery of all my intelligence and energy. Then in a low tone of voice, I said to the chief of police, "Be kind enough, sir, to wake him up gently, and if he inquires about me, tell him I have left for Paris. If he sees me, this might prove fatal to him." I must admit that from this moment, the police chief was as reasonable as possible. The first things Van Gogh asked for when he regained the power of speech were his pipe and his friend Gauguin. Gauguin had instructed the chief of police to say he was in Paris because, he writes, he could not trust himself completely as he was still in shock from being arrested, however briefly, for murder. Van Gogh admitted himself to an asylum, and the following year he took a gun out into a field. He said he was going to shoot rooks, but he shot and killed himself. But there's rather a lovely memorial to their friendship. 10 years later, when Gauguin was living in Tahiti, he sent to France for sunflower seeds, planted them in his garden, brought them to flower, arranged them in a vase, and painted them. "In memory," he wrote, "of my gentle friend, Vincent." In 1889, the Eiffel Tower went up for a world fair, basically a trade fair selling machines for mass production. 32 million visitors attended the fair. Gauguin hated industrialization. Factories were an affront to human dignity. Mass production was an affront to human creativity. He fled back to his wild place, Brittany, where he read mystical books and painted an extraordinary series of paintings of the life of Jesus Christ, reimagining Christ living in Brittany. Here, in Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane, we see Christ in a place recognizable today, a wood behind a particular Brittany beach. Gauguin gives Christ his own face, topped by Vincent's red hair. So the image synthesizes Jesus Christ, Gauguin, and Van Gogh in one single person, united in suffering. Gauguin is often called a synthesis. And the fused identities in this picture are as complex as the fused identities in the vision of the sermon I showed you earlier. And of course, it's in the Garden of Gethsemane that Peter cut off the ear of Malchus, the high priest. Rather gruesome synthesis. France was paying people to go and live in the colonies. Why not? He wangled a free passage out to be the first official artist in Tahiti. But before leaving, he visited Mette and the children in Denmark. And here he is with two of them. Gauguin promised Mette he'd get rich painting portraits in Tahiti. And then he'd send for them all. And they'd live like barefoot beachcombers, happily ever after. Arriving in Tahiti in 1891 was a shock. He was confronted by the French, the results of the French civilizing mission, the mission civilisatrice. And this is what the capital, Papeete, looked like in 1891. Native huts were forbidden in the capital. It was a complete cultural takeover. Tahiti had only been a colony for about 9 years, and the few thousand indigenous Polynesians were oppressed and exploited by some 400 police, soldiers, and administrators. By the time Gauguin arrived, missionaries had pretty much obliterated every vestige of the old religion and culture. Temples and artifacts were smashed, polyandry and nudity were forbidden. Polynesians were made crushingly conscious of being steeped in sin. Men were made to wear jackets and women long dresses, concealing every inch of sinful flesh. Once more, Gauguin found himself a misfit, a wild thing, surrounded by uniforms and linen suits. And he soon moved to a village down the coast to live with the locals as a local in a traditional hut. Frenchmen didn't do this. He was generously welcomed into the community. He was offered a girl, Tehemana. The custom was that a sexually experienced girl was offered by her family. She lived with her new husband for a week. Then she went back to her family for a week. If she liked the man, she went back to him. Tehemana came back. She was 15. It was a consensual relationship. Tehemana was free to come and go, to take other lovers. They lived together for 2 years. Tehemana told him the myths and legends of her people. And this picture is called Tehemana Has Many Parents. As well as being a portrait of an individual, it's a portrait of a culture in flux. Tehemana wears a missionary dress, but carries a Polynesian fan. Above her, a line of mysterious hieroglyphs echo the few ancient survivals that the missionaries hadn't smashed up. Behind her stands Hina, the Polynesian goddess of the moon and creation. So Tehemana is a synthesis of many cultures and many bloodlines, as we all are, going down the centuries. So Tehemana has many parents indeed. Maybe Gauguin's roots in Peru are the foundation of his belief in cultural synthesis. Today, it's often seen as cultural appropriation. His view was, and I quote his words, "The wooden rocking horse in my nursery is descended from the horses of the Parthenon," which is a pretty neat summary of cultural synthesis, if you think about it. Equally, he saw the human race as a great synthesis, race, creed, and color. One of the first pictures he painted in Tahiti was this one, Teorania Maria, Hail Mary, 1891. A Polynesian Mary carries the Polynesian Christ child on her shoulders. Their halos merge. Two traditionally clad, bare-bested Tahitian vahinis take the place of the three wise men come to worship. And the gorgeous angel with gold-blue wings has swooped down to earth wearing a modest missionary dress. When it was exhibited in Paris, the picture caused a scandal. A non-white Holy Family. It was not until 1951 that a papal encyclical made it permissible to represent such a thing, which is pretty stupid if you think about where Mary and Joseph came from. Manau Tupapao, Spirit of the Dead Watching. This is the picture that's done most damage to Gauguin's reputation, and I can very easily see why. It can be seen as misogynistic, exploitative, colonialist, but there are other ways of seeing it too. For Tehemana, as for most Polynesians, Christianity was a veneer. She still believed in Tupapao, terrifying spirits who stole your spirit in the dark. For that reason, she always kept a lamp burning in their hut. One evening, the oil lamp had gone out, and Gauguin found her terrified by the dark. Gauguin embodies her fear in the figure of the Tupapao at the foot of the bed for our benefit. But what he wanted to capture, he says, was Tehemana's terror of the unseen. When Gauguin sent the picture back to his wife Mette to exhibit and sell in Denmark, she was not offended by it. She wrote that she thought it wonderful. Mette herself was also frightened of the dark, and she too also kept a lamp burning. And there's an interesting PS in that in 1992, Naomi Campbell had herself photographed stark naked in the same pose in a photo feature initiated by her for Harper's Bazaar as a homage to Gauguin. I can't show you the picture on account of copyright, but you can look it up on the internet. And Naomi Campbell said that she saw Manau Tupapao as a strong depiction of an independent black woman. So there are ways and ways of seeing. Gauguin couldn't make a living in Tahiti. The French civil servants were not exactly art collectors. He had to go to Paris, taking some 100 pictures with him. The painter Degas admired Gauguin's pictures enormously. In fact, he became the chief collector of Gauguin's work in his lifetime. Degas organized an exhibition. It was not a success. Paris was not ready for racial or cultural synthesis. Teorania Maria showing the Holy Family as Polynesians caused particular offense. Abstracted landscapes, like the one you see here, were simply incomprehensible to people who are now paying a lot of money for Impressionism. Gauguin's dreams of taking Paris by storm were shattered. As usual, he was broke, but he got a bit of money from giving lessons in an art school, where one of the models was this woman, Anna the Javanese. All we know about Anna was that she was trafficked to Paris to become a maid to an opera singer. Soon she began to model in the art school where Gauguin taught. Summer came. They traveled together to Gauguin's beloved Brittany. Anna went nowhere without her parrot and her monkey. And one day as they were walking together, the sight of the white painter with the black woman and her exotic pets was too much for the local fishermen. 15 of them set upon Gauguin, knocked him to the ground, and kicked him nearly to death with their wooden clogs. His ankle was splintered, his shattered shin bone stuck out through his skin. It was an injury he would never recover from. Bedridden, high on morphine, thinking he was going to die, Gauguin's dreams were haunted by Oviri, the Polynesian goddess of death and mourning. Tehemana had told him about Oviri. She's one of those goddesses who devours her children. And Gauguin made this statue of Oviri. He stipulated it was to stand on his tomb. And here's me, beside his tomb, beside Oviri. She stands there still. The open wound on his leg never healed properly. From now on, he would always walk with a stick. He set about hobbling around Paris to organize a sale of his paintings to raise money for his fare back to Tahiti. Only 11 out of the 47 paintings sold, 2 to Degas. He had spent 2 years in France. Before he left, he set up a contract with a dodgy art dealer who promised a percentage on works sold. Gauguin would ship pictures back, which took roughly 2 months. The dealer would send the money back when he had sold them, another 2 months or more. Another problem was art supplies. There were no art shops in Tahiti. Luckily, paints came in tubes these days, but he had to send to Paris for them. If he needed a particular shade, he'd have to hold the concept in his head until the right supplies arrived. If he ran out of canvas, he picked up copra sacks discarded from the agricultural production and painted on them, which has made life quite difficult for conservators. When he sent his pictures back to Paris, Degas would be waiting on the quay to get first pick. Gauguin also sent back pictures to Mette in Denmark, and sometimes she sent him money in return for what she sold, but sometimes she didn't. Mette had the children to pay for, after all. The boat to Tahiti pulled in on New Zealand, where he was excited to see the Maori carving, tattooing, and textile art that had so much in common with the Polynesian arts of the islands. Another world synthesis. When he arrived back in 1885, he was in for a shock. Papiete was now powered by artificial light. He hated this falsification of night. Once more, he fled to the countryside. Tehemana had married another man while he was in Paris, but she came back to spend a couple of weeks with him, for old time's sake. His neighbors offered him another girl called Pahura, and she was very different to the introverted and rather cerebral Tehemana. Pahura loved gossiping and parties, and she loved to model for him. And here she is, the king's wife, 1896. I seem to have shown you a lot of nudes, but actually, of the approximately 200 paintings in Tahiti, only about 20 were nudes. The majority were landscapes or figures in social situations. And this is Gauguin's first attempt at a full frontal recumbent nude. At last, he felt himself ready to challenge the classical icon coming down from Rome and Greece through Cranach, Giorgione, Titian, Velázquez, Goya, and of course, in his own time, Manet's Olympia. What makes it so very Gauguin for me is the emphasis he places on the gorgeous Tahitianness of it all. Tropical colors, mangoes, cows, a very local take on the Garden of Eden. Look at the snake winding round the trunk. It's obviously an Eve beneath the Tree of Knowledge, but the forbidden fruit aren't apples, they're mangoes. Pahura conceived a child, but it died soon after it was born. And Gauguin lamented his lost child in this picture, Nevermore, 1897. It's his only English title, and of course it references Edgar Allan Poe's poem, Nevermore, Lamenting a Dead Lover. Pahura lived to be an old woman breeding guinea pigs, and she's the only one to have been interviewed. She recalled Gauguin with affection and laughter. C'était un coquin, she said. What a rascal. Mette wrote to him to tell them that their only daughter, Eileen, was dead, and Gauguin was distraught. He painted this self-portrait near Golgotha, continuing his Via Dolorosa in the footsteps of Christ. And he also painted this. Where do we come from? Who are we? Where are we going? Gauguin meant this picture as his last will and testament, his verdict on his time on this earth. You may not realize it, but your eyes will have gone straight to the left-hand side. That's how we read paintings in the West from left to right, like lines in books. But your eyes starting at the left will have encountered a figure bending towards a bright white goose that acts as a full stop at bottom left. So your eye naturally springs from there to the right-hand side, and you start reading from right to left. And Gauguin did this on purpose, to unsettle us before he tells his creation story. It's interesting that Picasso followed Gauguin's example in his most political story, the vast anti-war canvas, Guernica. Both men want us to be thoroughly unsettled as we take in what they consider their most important message. Okay, so we start on the right, where Gauguin's alter ego, a Peruvian dog fox, bounds into the world. His paws point to the baby. New life starts, watched over by three figures, possibly the three fates. Two sages in long robes equal wisdom. And all this happens against a primal swirl, an undifferentiated landscape. Then the picture is bisected by a standing figure plucking the fruit from the Tree of Knowledge, a rather androgynous Polynesian Eve picking mangoes. And the picture space on the left references the fallen world. The primal swirl has resolved into landscape, land and sea. Agriculture has started. People keep animals. A man-made idol is worshipped. Superstition has entered the world, and death. An old woman will soon die, but where will she go then? Gauguin closes the story with a white goose crushing a lizard in its claws. It is, Gauguin explained, a symbol of the futility of seeking an explanation. And he wrote about this picture, all the stuff I've told you he wrote. So when the canvas was finished, he'd done his life work, he tried to kill himself. He took poison, but then he vomited. He felt he was a failure, even as a suicide. Now his political conscience awoke. He started to fight through indigenous rights. He wrote to the press, attacking the injustice of the French administration. His letters were published in the local paper, which offered Gauguin a job at 50 francs a month. And political satire suited him admirably. The words came easy and he drew wicked cartoons. He wrote to the ministry in Paris, exposing the corruption and injustice of the colonialist regime. The governor brought a libel suit against him. Gauguin knew he had no chance of winning in the corrupt Tahitian colonial court. He'd be fined and clapped in prison. Time to get away from Tahiti. 10 days' journey by boat got him to this little island called Hiva'oa, some 900 miles across the ocean, but still a French colony. On arrival, he was amazed to be mobbed like a celebrity. Not for his painting, but for his crusading journalism. As he walked down the only street, he was followed by a crowd. At the general store, he entertained everybody to tea and cakes. Everything on Hiva'oa was run by the Roman Catholic bishop, Father Martin. If Gauguin went to church every day, he'd get his plot of land to build a house. It took 11 days. He never set foot in the bishop's church again. They became deadly enemies as Gauguin set about championing the local people and restoring the old ways. He started provocatively by building a maison de jouir, a traditional communal house that had been banned by the missionaries, a gathering place for the locals who could behave as they had in the old days, before Christianity was imposed on them, singing and dancing and drinking and flirting and pairing up for a little sex without feeling sinful. The islanders loved him. He was invited to exchange names, the highest honor. It's like becoming a blood brother. When you exchange names, you exchange souls and all your property, and you had your wives in common too. The French hated him, particularly Bishop Martin, a fearsome Puritan who had forbidden nudity, polyandry, the sacred art of tattooing and dancing the erotic upa upa. But everyone knew that Bishop Martin had a 15-year-old mistress called Thérèse. And Gauguin carved these two figures of the bishop and his mistress and set them up in his garden. So everyone giggled as they went by, and you can imagine the bishop's fury. Gauguin continued his work as the people's champion. A murder occurred. The wrong man was accused, plainly because he was black. Gauguin fought and won the case. People wrote to him from other islands to right their wrongs. But his greatest victory concerned the children of Hiva'oa, where Bishop Martin compelled all the children, boys and girls, to attend Catholic boarding school to the age of 14. They were taught only in French, and the aim really was to erase the Polynesian language, culture, family structure, and national identity in one generation. The children's parents were distraught. Gauguin discovered a minor French law that only children living within 4 kilometers of a school need attend it. Mass relocation ensued. Language, culture, and family unity survived on the island, and Gauguin became more popular than ever. The governor reported back to Gauguin that was, I quote, "a defender of native vices, a subverter of the rule of law, and a dangerous anarchist." Gauguin was a marked man. When he accused a gendarme on a nearby island of accepting bribes, the governor responded with a charge of libel. The case was heard by the local French magistrate. Gauguin was found guilty, fined 500 francs, and sentenced to 3 months in prison. Barely a year later, the case would be re-examined, and Gauguin's accusations found to be correct. But by that time, he was dead. This is the final self-portrait. There's a theory that Gauguin committed suicide, that unable to pay the fine and unable to face 3 months in prison, he took an overdose of morphine. We'll never know for sure. But the two medically qualified men on the island both believed that Gauguin's heart gave out, and this seems perfectly feasible. His father had died of heart disease, aged 34, his mother at 41. Gauguin had suffered at least 2 heart attacks. He was 54 when he died. So it's not impossible that the prospect of prison and a fine he couldn't pay brought on a fatal attack. Gauguin's lifeless corpse was discovered by his Polynesian brother, blood brother rather, Tioka, who planned to bury him next day in the common cemetery for Polynesian people. But early next morning, Bishop Martin snatched Gauguin's body to be buried in the Catholic cemetery, another soul claimed for the Catholic Church. But Gauguin got the last laugh on Bishop. Here's Gauguin's grave on Hivaoa, and above it, through the tree, you can see the white railings surrounded Bishop Martin's tomb. Gauguin's statue of Aviri, the Tahitian goddess of death, stands on Gauguin's tomb as he wished. So horny old Bishop Martin is forever doomed to gaze down at Aviri's naked back view. I've galloped through Gauguin's life, guilty of many sins of omission, how good he was at fencing, how he was always challenging people to duels when he thought his honor was at stake, how Van Gogh was in awe of his cookery talents, how he loved to surf, how he loved to play the guitar, how he shipped an organ out to Tahiti to play Handel in the evenings as night fell, how he was a bloody awkward loner, but always perceiving the synthesis of the human spirit. And there are so many gorgeous pictures I haven't had time to show you. I haven't even touched on his graphic works, his ceramics, his carvings, but I hope I've given you an idea of an extraordinary brave spirit, a wild thing, always moving on, always seeking the Peru of the soul, a man of integrity according to his own eccentric rules, always seeking truth in his life and in his art. Thank you.
Not so much a question as a statement, but this was just a really, really enjoyable and beautiful overview of an individual we had never known. So it's really a thank you more than a question. But if a question is owed, I wonder whether you have looked at other artists as well. And, you know, I mean, this is just really banal as a question, I guess, but I just wonder whether someone who picks up painting at the late stage that he did, what that makes you think about the idea of innate talent versus training and inspiration.
Yes, innate talent, it's extraordinary, isn't it? When you see that bust of Mehta, the first bust he carved, I mean, it was just there, wasn't it? And, well, when he turned his hand to it, out it came. But he did say that he was sort of asleep, like a sort of gosling hatched from the egg, very, very late, really. He only sort of entered the conscious world in his sort of 20s. He knew that he matured very late.
Thank you for that. Really, really interesting. Can you say what kind of contact he had with his children once his wife had gone back?
Yes, he and Mehta, they're always writing, actually, until the death of Eileen. And he's always saying, you know, I'm going to be making money, you know, I'm going to be able to get you all out here, etc. And they correspond a lot. As I said, he sends the paintings back to her and she sells them. And as a result, there are a lot of very good Gauguins in Scandinavian collections. When she sent the letter to him saying that Eileen had died, she caught cold in a carriage on the way back from a ball in Copenhagen, and I suppose got pneumonia. Anyway, she died in a few days. And she, I think, had died in February, and Gauguin didn't get the letter till April, and he was absolutely distraught. And after that, he just cut off everything. He couldn't bear it.
Thanks for that absolutely brilliant talk. I missed the very beginning of it, and the first 5 minutes, and I don't know if you mentioned anything about Nietzsche, because I absolutely loved your biography of Nietzsche. And I was wondering if you could draw any comparisons between the lives of Gauguin and Nietzsche, and as a biographer, was it very different getting to know these two characters?
It's always very different. I always approach my subjects. I'm interested in the work. That's where I start. Through the work, you know, I feel, well, I want to know more about this man. And so it's the work that leads me to the man. And of course, they're very, very different, but very, very similar. If you're thinking about Nietzsche and Gauguin, they are both introverted, extremely cerebral, secretive, really, and complete believers in themselves. I mean, Nietzsche said, "I'm not a man, I'm dynamite," you know, which a motto I have taken up. And Gauguin definitely knew he was a great artist.
Hello.
Here we are. The time has come.
Yeah, the time has come. I'm sorry. I know it's absolutely fascinating. We've had three really good questions. And Sue, it just remains for me to say thank you. Can everybody put their hands together for Sue?